Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Tonight's guest is Dr. Bruce Grayson, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran, and I am excited about our guest tonight, Dr. Bruce Grayson. I can assure everybody a fascinating discussion, as he is a world-renowned expert in near-death experiences. I know you had some articles. We were following this terrible news story that happened in New York this week about a 9-year-old boy, and he was going to day camp, and the parents arranged for him for the very first time to walk by himself halfway home.
Meet them halfway. They had a meeting point so he can learn how to walk home by himself.
And he got a little disoriented, and he stopped to ask a stranger for directions, and it turned out that this was a killer, and the boy was killed, and his body dismembered. The police discovered it a day or two later. You know, you pulled out an article that says something about grief.
They were talking about, you know, the loss that the parents suffer. And I know we talk about this a lot. I know a lot of our members are parents who have lost children, and it's an unbelievable pain, because not only are you without the person, but you've lost every potential bit of future that you would have had with that person. So it's a very, very difficult situation to live through. Even during the immediacy of the grief, where you're totally, totally numb by the issue that happened. Now, what happened was, in this article, they were writing about ways people can help the parents and what they were doing to help the parents. And the person who wrote the article wrote about a similar incident where there was a situation where parents had lost a child. And they said there was a tragedy that involved a young child. No one could think of any words that might alleviate the suffering of the parents. They tried, but they found themselves wanting. The scene was indelibly etched in his mind. A group of us went to the parents, hugged them, tried to say something, but they choked up and they simply cried. Days later, the parents came back to them and thanked them, telling them that they helped them get through the tragedy. Not for anything they did, not for any words, but because of their tears. This is what they said. You showed us that the pain wasn't ours alone. Your sharing our grief made it somewhat bearable.
Yeah, and that's always a question that a lot of people have, people that are fortunate enough not to have faced the death of someone, you know, close to them, and they commonly ask, you know, what do I say? You know, what, as you point out, there really is nothing that you could say, but somehow, you know, sharing pain is somewhat cathartic. You know, if you just nod or hug or shed a tear, that you feel it, you know, so they know that they're not alone, seems to be the best method, you know.
Yeah. And it works. It works because it's almost like you're not there shouldering the burden yourself, that there's somebody there that's gonna be there with you and understand it. I mean, when you see somebody shed a tear for your suffering, you've linked.
And also, it's without saying words, it's saying, you know, I understand, you know. So, you know, because one of the thoughts that go through your mind is that nobody could possibly understand, you know. So I guess that's the best advice to give to somebody that's in mourning, is just to be around and just to acknowledge, you know, the pain, and try not to say stupid things.
I know, and it is very, very true. And I have one other little quote. The father of this young boy actually said, and this is translated from his spoken language, he said, "At least we had the merit of having him for 9 years."
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's a... an optimistic way of looking at it. You know, we hear from a lot of people that are, you know, in mourning, and unfortunately they can't even bring themselves to think of it that way. Well,
right.
I had them for a certain number of years. They just,
because the pain is just so great. It's like, it's almost like if I had never met them, I wouldn't be suffering right now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that also struck me about the story is you say to yourself, my God, it just... the first day, you know, that you know, the boy, you know, walks home, you know, and then, of course, you get into all the emotions that come with it, you know, with the parents and the family and the guilt, and I could have done this, or
they're going to beat themselves up for years.
It shows you, again, how fragile each day is. I mean, the decisions that we make that you can't possibly foresee any serious action to, you know, can change the course of our entire lives in the blink of an eye. Every decision that we make may seem trivial and meaningless, and it turns out to be a bomb, you know, so, or the other way, you know, could turn out to be something that good that stays with you and gives you joy for the rest of your life. So, boy, life sure is a trip.
Oh yeah.
Well, we're going to go to our break, and when we come back, we will have Dr. Bruce Grayson, MD, with us to talk about near-death experience research, so stay with us. We'll be back in a few.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org, or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Grayson. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Bob?
And Bruce Grayson, MD, is the Carlson Professor of Psychiatry. He's the director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia Health System. Dr. Grayson is the foremost active researcher in the field of near-death studies and was the longtime editor of the Journal of Near-Death Studies. He's one of the first researchers to gather empirical data on the near-death experience using accepted scientific methods. Dr. Grayson is one of the founders of the International Association for Near-Death Studies and served for many years on their board of directors, as their president, as their director of research. His research for the past three decades has focused on the after effects of near-death experiences and has resulted in more than 70 presentations to national scientific conferences, more than 100 publications in academic, medical, and psychological journals, and has had several research grants and awards. He's also the co-author of two books, The Handbook of Near-Death Experience and Irreducible Mind. Welcome, Dr. Grayson.
Thank you, Bob. Good evening.
Good evening. Do you think that people today are more willing to open up about their near-death experience than they were, say, 20 years ago?
I think that's definitely the case. Mm. When we first started doing this research back in the late 70s and early 80s, most people were very reluctant to talk about it. And in fact, most healthcare professionals didn't really want to hear about it. And now it has become so well publicized. I mean, even Homer Simpson's had a near-death experience.
Yeah.
That, you know, people are less afraid to talk about it.
Yeah.
And quite often now, when I talk to medical audiences, I will have doctors get up in the audience and talk about their own near-death experiences. So things have changed quite a bit.
Hmm. I think that there is still, it's true what you say, that a large percentage of the general public has heard the term. I don't know necessarily that, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about, you know, misuse of the term. I talk to people and they say, oh yeah, I know what a near-death experience is. That's when you die and you go through a tunnel. But they don't realize that there are many varied types of experiences. So maybe you could get into a little bit of these other types of reported experiences that people have.
Right. Well, that's right. There are a wide variety of things that people can experience when they have a near-death experience or NDE. And most commonly, the most profound part usually is just a tremendous sense of peace and well-being. And remember, this is in the context of being close to death, where people are often in great pain, very frightened, and they're suddenly overwhelmed by this wonderful sense of well-being and a sense of being loved. They will sometimes go through a tunnel, sometimes have a sense of leaving their physical bodies. Sometimes that's just a vague sense of not knowing where the body is. Sometimes of actually being able to see the body from some other perspective. They may encounter deceased loved ones. They may encounter religious figures. They may just encounter beings they can't identify, spiritual beings that emanate sort of a warm, loving, welcoming feeling. Sometimes they may have a life review. They may have a life preview at times. And at some point, they may come to a point where they make a decision to return to the body, or sometimes they are told, it's not your time, you need to return.
And people report these out-of-body experiences, often these veridical experiences where they're sometimes seeing their own body from a different perspective. So is that, when you talk about veridical experiences, that's where you're separated from your physical body and you're looking down upon it? That would be an example of one?
Right, and the important part to make it veridical is that what you see is actually what's there. It's accurate. You know, some materialists like to say that this is all a hallucination, that there are places you can stimulate in the temporal lobe to give people an illusion of leaving the body. And if it were nothing more than an illusion, then what you see would not correspond to reality. But in fact, people having near-death experiences describe very accurately what's going on around the body, sometimes reporting very unusual and surprising things that they couldn't have guessed. And that's one strong piece of evidence that these are not hallucinations. They are, in fact, accurate perceptions.
Yeah, one thing that I learned from you early on, listening to your lectures and reading your books and your articles, is that struck me as so compelling is the fact that if we attribute consciousness as strictly a product, of a living brain, and people report these experiences at a time when there's either no brain function or their brain function is severely impaired, and they have these tremendously lucid and sensory experiences. I mean, to me, that's the most compelling evidence that the near-death experience has to offer. Do you agree with that?
Certainly, yes. That's a large piece of evidence that the brain and the mind are not the same thing. And what makes it more compelling is that there's lots of other evidence from other experiences that corroborates this. It's not just the near-death experience. There's a whole range of spiritual experiences where the mind and the body can seem to operate separately.
One of the things I always wanted to ask you, I know that a lot of people, including myself, I have a hard time losing control. You know, I mean, even if I try to meditate and I feel myself going, there's something about me that wants to pull myself back in. Or if I've had a drug that's administered to me and I feel like I'm losing control, it's uncomfortable to me. Do you hear that from people that have near-death experiences, that they feel themselves like leaving their body and that somehow they're afraid to let it happen?
Well, on rare occasions we do. Most of the times, it happens so quickly and so unexpectedly that people don't have time to think about what that feels like. They just sort of find themselves out there, out of their bodies. The impressive thing about the near-death experience is that it is not under your control, that you totally lose control. You are not in control. Something else is, or sometimes it feels like nothing is. But if you reflect on the idea of losing control, that can be terrifying. And there are some reports of people who have what sound like regular near-death experiences, leaving the body, going through a tunnel, seeing a light, and they are very upset by being out of control, and the whole experience is very frightening for them, and they struggle against it. And then at some point, they get exhausted and stop fighting. And as soon as they stop struggling against it, it becomes a typical blissful experience. the struggle that makes it unpleasant.
Do they, when people are reporting on their experience, and I realize it's very difficult for them to put it into words, but do they ever talk about trying to communicate with people while they're in that state, you know, either by verbally or by thought, some thought process, or do they try to get a message to them that, hey, I'm here?
You mean people who are still alive?
Yeah, people that may be, let's say, people that are in the operating room while they're...
Yes, we do hear that. Very often, it'll happen where someone has left the body and is feeling quite comfortable up above the body, and they see the doctors and nurses frantically trying to revive the body, and they'll be trying to tell the doctors, I'm okay, leave me alone, let me go, I'm fine, stop. And they don't get through. It's as if nobody who is still alive can hear them.
Hmm. I wonder if they ever do get through. People just, well, usually the medical personnel are too busy to recognize it, right?
Yeah, actually, we do have some reports of people who are strongly emotionally bonded to the near-death experiencer who do receive communications during the near-death experience.
Hmm.
Raymond Moody has written recently about what he calls shared near-death experiences, where someone will be going into a near-death experience, and then a loved one who is still alive will start to experience part of that with the one who's dying.
Yeah, and I, you know, we had Dr. Moody on the show, and I was totally unaware of that, you know. But since then, you know, in going back and reading some of the channeled reports for, you know, whether you believe in their authenticity or not, a lot of people when they communicate from the afterlife talk about. Things like the people that were in the room talk about seeing a mist, like when somebody passes away, or
right.
a silver cord. And I was wondering if, with the silver cord, some sort of connection between this ethereal body or a soul body and a physical body. Did near-death experiences ever report this connection that would be similar to a cord, or feel that like they were still connected to the body or released from the body in some way?
They do on occasion, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah,
that's something that has been reported in some of the ancient literatures and the theosophical literature, so we might have expected it to be fairly common. But most near-death experiences do not report anything like a silver cord or any type of physical connection to the physical body.
Yeah. I realize that this may be more of a, well, it is more of a philosophical question than a scientific one, but obviously all the people that you study come back, and often they talk about reaching a point of decision or a point of no return where they either have to continue on to another dimension, or they're being told that they have to return to the physical body.
Right.
And sometimes they don't have any input, you know, into that. So I guess it's feasible, since we don't have the data on everybody, because we only know about the people that do come back, that
that's right.
It's possible that everybody faces that decision point.
That's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, you suppose that there might be... I don't think we can ever research it, but I guess there's is that in the realm of your thinking, that everyone might have that experience of reaching that initial point?
They may. It's possible that the people who go on not to recover, who remain on the other side, have a different experience than those who come back. We don't have any way of knowing that for sure, but it's theoretically possible. I'm not sure there's any strong reason to think that, though.
Yeah.
We do have some evidence that bears on the question. For example, Ian Stevenson and now Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia have been studying young children who claim to remember past lives. And a small number of those also describe what happened between the past life and this one. And what they report is often very similar to what near-death experiences report. So we have some evidence then that what NDEers report is actually what people who have gone to die will experience.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm always looking at the contrast between the people that have the near-death experience and these channel reports. I mean, a lot of people in these channel reports talk about an initial confusion after death, that they don't quite know what's going on. And then another point, some even call it like a second death, where some clarity seems to come. But the near-death experiences seem to have clarity immediately. So the two don't seem to jive, unless you were talking in spiritual terms, that one could say that it's because the near-death experiencer didn't have their soul totally released yet. You know, so I guess there's no way to research that scientifically. But
well, that's a possibility that the near-death experiencer hasn't totally broken off from the physical body the way that the channeled entities have. But you have to remember that we're dealing with verbal reports, which are a distortion of what really happened.
Mm.
And most near-death experiences will say, I really can't put into words what happened to me. And then we say, that's great, tell me all about it. You know, so we make them put into words, knowing that that's going to be distorting it. Now, when we talk to near-death experiencers, we're dealing with their own distortions only. When you're dealing with a channeled entity, you're also dealing with what the medium distorts. So you've got two sources of distortion there, the channeled entity and the medium, both trying to put it into words.
Right.
It's also possible that those entities that are around to be channeled are different from the others. Maybe they are the ones that had more confusion when they first left, and that's why they are still around.
That's certainly plausible. The people that... the near-death experiences, that when they talk about these clear memories that they have, I guess that's very strong evidence that our memories might be stored, you know, outside of our brains, you know, and then these experiences are able to regain or retrieve these memories. And I know a lot of scientists now talk about these fields that are out there, whether it's a morphic field or some sort of other quantum field, but... The near-death experience, in your opinion, does that show that memories are not stored in the brain?
Well, I think it does. It shows that whatever it is that thinks and feels and makes decisions is not part of the physical brain.
Hmm.
And that can have memories and it can form memories and perceive things without the use of the brain and the physical senses.
If we... do more work in studying the people's, you know, physical brains during a near-death experience, do you think that it's possible one day we could discover an area in the brain or some sort of chemical that's produced in the brain that helps to facilitate the connection, not necessarily cause it, but facilitate the experience in some way?
Well, that's a difficult question because it's really hard to study the brain of someone while they're having a near-death experience.
Yeah.
Mario Beauregard at University of Montreal has asked near-death experiencers to try to remember as vividly as possible the near-death experience while they're having their brains imaged. And he looks at what parts of the brain light up when they're doing that. And as you might expect, a lot of parts of the brain do, because you're involving senses, you're involving hearing, you're involving vision, you're involving emotion, you're involving cognition. So all those parts of the brain are lit up. So I think when someone is talking about a near-death experience or remembering it, they're using their physical brain. When you're actually in the near-death experience, you may not be using the brain at all, but you may need the brain later to talk about it.
Hmm. That makes sense. Tell us a little bit about this AWARE study. I mean, I know that it's a tremendously comprehensive undertaking, and people are probably not familiar with it. So can you give us a brief overview of it?
Yes, this was the brainchild of Dr. Sam Parnia, who was a British cardiologist, and now he's over here in the U.S. He actually is at Stony Brook University. And he's doing this study to try to identify veridical out-of-body perceptions during near-death experiences. And he has, I think, around 20 hospitals in the United Kingdom working on this, and a few elsewhere in the world. The University of Virginia, where I am, is one of the sites that's involved with this. And what they've done, what we've done is put visual targets in hospital rooms high above people's heads facing up, so you can only see the targets if you're looking down from the ceiling. And the idea is that when someone has a spontaneous cardiac arrest, when their hearts stop in the hospital, they may leave their bodies and look down and see these targets. So after they are resuscitated, if they are resuscitated, we will then go in and interview them and ask them what they remember from that period when their hearts had stopped. And looking for people who can say, yes, I rose out of my body and I saw this particular image up on the shelf.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Yes, he has several hospitals working on this, and I think it's going to need to go on for many years before we have any reportable results. There are not that many people who survive cardiac arrests in the hospital. So you have to go through an awful lot of cardiac arrests to get people who are able to talk about what they remember. And then only a small portion of those will actually have a near-death experience. And of those, only a small portion will leave their bodies. And of those, only a small portion may happen to look at the target.
Right. And I know that you've addressed the issue before, but one of the conjectures about the results would be, you know, if you died, especially if you thought that death was the end, and suddenly you woke up and you saw you were still alive, you'd be pretty amazed. So you might not notice or think to look at a target that's hidden.
So that's right.
Yeah.
Most near-death experiencers who do hang around the body talk about looking at the body, and occasionally you will hear their attention being attracted by something else unusual in the room, but it's pretty random what they end up fixing their attention on. I don't think you can count on them fixing on what Dr. Parnia or someone else has designated as the right target.
Well, I had a thought when I first heard, since so many people do report that have experience, a near-death experience, that some sort of a fascination with looking down at their body, I don't know if it's logistically possible, but why not put the target, you know, suspended directly over the body? You know, it seems from a lot of reports that, you know, the denseness of matter doesn't matter to this vision that you have, you know, when you're out of body. And if people are fascinated with looking at their body, why not put the target there?
Right. Well, it would be ideal to put it right on the chest, but then everyone else in the room would see it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard enough now with the target elevated that the critics can always say, well, somebody climbed up on a ladder and looked at the target and then happened to mention it to the patient. So, you know, there's no way to protect against that.
Yeah.
But you want to make the target as hard as possible for other people to see.
Not easy to study near-death experience, is it?
Why?
I would imagine the protocol, you know, is when you're designing these things, has to be as airtight as you could possibly make it to, you know, rule out these other explanations that are constantly thrown up at you, you know, such as you know, misfiring of the brain and anoxia and everything else. So,
that's right. And another big concern, because these studies are done in hospitals, is protecting the patient's rights. There are all sorts of regulations about what you can and can't do to patients in a hospital to make sure they're not being harmed by the study. And that puts some constraints on the study as well.
Yeah.
For example, one of the things that Sam wanted to do in the AWARE study was all sorts of physiological measurements of what's going on, measuring the oxygen level in the brain and so forth. And my hospital would not agree to let those things happen, because putting on those monitors would take precious seconds away from the resuscitation attempts. So, you know, there are limits to what you can and can't do.
Yeah, well, that's understandable saving the patient. That's his primary.
Sure.
Yeah. Right, we're going to take a short break and return with Dr. Grayson, so stay with us.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's Hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Grayson. This show is sponsored by the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. If you're a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. With these hard economic times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show. They want to see it continue. They love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have the extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do, and yet we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. But you don't have to stop there. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we will receive a donation. And when you find your items, a portion of what you spend, again, is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our Holidays Past raffle, you can win any of the five chances for a one-hour medium reading. Support our work with a $5 chance, five chances for $20. Visit the website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, for more information on entering the raffle, or you can mail in your check to Forever Family Foundation, 222 Atlantic Avenue, Oceanside, New York, 11572. Our annual conference is Their Chocolate in the Afterlife, with a feature Friday night fundraiser, Night of Mediums, which is set for November 11th. That's 11-11-11, the most spiritual day of the year. At the Sheraton Long Island Hotel in Hop Hog, New York, we have early bird pricing and special group rate hotel rooms. This is a limited seating conference and fundraiser, so book early to avoid disappointment. Again, at the website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, you can get all your information and you can make your reservations there. We have our Holidays Past event, an evening of spirit communication conducted by Forever Family Foundation certified mediums this year in three locations so far. December 3rd, Joanne Gerber will be in Bethel, Connecticut. December 10th, Angelina Diana will be in Natick, Massachusetts with afterlife advocate Dave Kane. And December 17th, Teresa Caputo will be in Melville, New York. It's $25 a seat for members. Again, on the website, you can make your reservations. Bob, back to you.
And thanks for staying with us, Dr. Grayson. You know, I was reading an article or an interview with you that you had given a number of years ago, and I never realized that when Raymond Moody was a resident in medical school, he was actually under your supervision. So I guess when he started to go public about collecting these near-death experiences, I mean, what was your reaction? Were you open to the possibility? Were you surprised by the interest that it generated?
Both. I was interested in it. I had been involved in parapsychology before that, so I was certainly open to the idea. But I didn't know about near-death experiences per se. And I was quite surprised to see how the public really resonated with Raymond's book. You mentioned that I was one of his supervisors. That's a little ironic because he's actually older than I am.
Right.
But he had been a philosophy professor before he went to medical school. So his journey through medicine was a little more delayed, and that's why I got ahead of him.
Yeah. Did he give him a hard time?
Not at all.
Do you think that, obviously you've been doing this for many years, do you think that your work initially was accepted by your so-called mainstream colleagues because you weren't necessarily focusing on evidence of survival, but you were focusing on the after effects and the implications of the near-death experience? Did that make it easier to gain acceptance?
Well, in some ways it did. Yeah. It certainly made it possible for me to publish this work in mainstream medical journals. But the cost of that was I had to be careful to avoid talking about any spiritual aspects of the experience. I could just talk about what people reported and how it changed them. For example, it often made people who had been suicidal less suicidal, and that's something that doctors wanted to know about so we could publish material about that. We could not publish anything about what it might imply for survival of death.
Hmm. One of the things that I guess it would be a benefit to society, I mean, as the public becomes more and more aware of these experiences that people are having, the near-death experience, do you think that it would make people lose their fear of death if they learned more about it?
I think they would, and that's a large part of why we're doing all this work. You know, the things that near-death experiences report, the way they think they have changed, the less fear of death, the greater sense of altruism, the greater sense of the importance of love and relationships, the decreased sense of interest in material things and power and prestige. If these things could be spread to society at large, it would be a lot nicer place to live in.
I agree. Well, which is, when it comes down to it, I mean, which is more important to you? I mean, is it the transforming effects of the NDE or accumulating evidence that the mind can act independently of the brain? Or are they equally important, or does one have a preference over the other?
Well, actually, for me, you know, I'm a psychiatrist, and my job is helping people make changes in their lives. And that is my bias. So from that perspective, what's important about the near-death experience is how it changes people.
Hmm.
I also think that if you're looking for evidence that we survive or that the mind can separate from the body, people have definite attitudes about that. And the evidence that we get from near-death experiences is not going to change people's minds. There are people who are diehard materialists who are not going to be convinced by this, no matter what we do. I think it's kind of beating your head against the wall, trying to accumulate more and more scientific evidence, when that's probably not what's going to make people change their minds.
So, well, but then again, a lot of the work done by the Division of Perceptual Studies that you direct focuses on the evidence in many different disciplines, right?
It does.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we really change people's minds.
Right.
We can certainly take people who are on the fence and convince them that there are legitimate reasons for believing in survival. But I don't think we've ever taken a diehard materialist and convinced them that there's more to life than just the body.
Yeah, until that diehard materialist has a near-death experience, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's the experience and not the logic that convinces people.
Right. I absolutely agree, and I've always said that it's... you know, to get from that point of believing to knowing, it takes some sort of a transforming personal experience to get there.
That's right.
You can read and you can listen and you can study intellectually. You make a case for it, but it's not till you have that experience, I think, that pushes you in one direction to the other.
All right. If you ask near-death experiencers what they believe about life after death, they will say to you, it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of knowledge.
Mm.
I've been there. I know. It's not a matter of belief.
Yeah. And incidentally, the Division of Perceptual Studies, there is a website that people could go to. If you go to healthsystem.virginia.edu/DOPS. That's healthsystem.virginia.edu/DOPS. And it's quite informative. You learn about the research on reincarnation and mediumship and some of the other disciplines. What are the disciplines that you study?
Well, the major projects are the near-death studies, the reincarnation studies, and the mediumship studies. We also have a state-of-the-art neuroimaging lab now, and we are studying a variety of things like healing and out-of-body experiences and remote viewing. While we were able to image the brain and see what's going on in the brain while people are having these experiences.
Hmm. Do you find often that people that have had a near-death experience have some sort of a lasting or an increase in their psychic ability after going through a near-death experience?
Yes, they do. We have a fair amount of data supporting that now, and it's a wide variety of experiences they have. They sometimes have continued out-of-body experiences. They often feel they have increased intuition, increased telepathic abilities. Sometimes they feel like they have healing abilities. And the ability to communicate with the other side sometimes persists. So I think it's like the near-death experience opens the door for you, and it's kind of hard to close it again once you've been there.
Hmm. Well, how prevalent is it? I mean, is there a percentage that you would say? Is it 10% that might have that, or?
It's hard to say. You know, we said before that people are much more willing to talk about their near-death experience than they used to be.
Yeah.
But there are limits to that. And people will share the fact that they've had an experience, but they may not want to share all the details of it. Some are just too personal. Some are just too hard to put into words. And there are things that people just don't want to talk about.
Yeah. Did when you were taking a report from somebody that is describing a near-death experience, I know that years ago you developed a scale. You used that scale to determine, if it was in fact a near-death experience versus something that was conjured up?
Well, the first thing we do is just get a narrative from the person. Just, you know, tell me what happened, and they describe it for us. And then after that, we will use the scale to put numbers on it for research purposes. But I wouldn't use the scale to tell somebody that you had or didn't have a near-death experience. You know, I've seen people who did not score very highly on the scale, but had tremendously profound experiences that really transformed their lives. And I certainly wouldn't tell them, no, you didn't have a near-death experience. It just wasn't one that happens to fit the scale.
Yeah. And people, you don't have to actually be have death imminent, be very, very close to death to have an experience. Isn't it true that people can have such an experience if they're in a traumatic situation?
That's true. In fact, the first paper published showing a large collection of these cases was published in 1892 by somebody who was a geology professor at the University of Zurich who had fallen when he was climbing in the Alps. And he had a near-death experience as he was falling. And he was so impressed by his own experience that he started asking other climbers and quickly found 30 other cases just like his, and he published this collection. Now, these are people whose hearts had not stopped. They were not close to death, although they feared they were going to die as they were falling. And it was just the near-death, the psychological near-death state that made them have the near-death experience.
Hmm. And they reported the same types of experiences?
They did.
Yeah.
We have a lot of reports now from people whose hearts have stopped because now we can bring them back. We couldn't 100 years ago.
Hmm.
And those reports are very much the same as those of people who have car accidents where the brakes catch at the very last second, or people who fall but their hearts don't stop, or people who nearly drown.
Hmm.
So we really can't say what difference it makes having your heart actually stop. You can have all the profound effects of a near-death experience without your heart stopping.
Hmm. I guess it's hard to also... it must be very... it's more compelling when you're taking a report from somebody and they tell you that they didn't believe in survival at all, you know, and now they're somewhat, you know, shocked by the experience. So
that's right.
Sort of rules
that's right.
out the fact that they read about, you know, a book about it, you know, and now they're just... putting their own words to it, but I'm always interested when even in other areas of research, when people absolutely are dead set against the possibility of survival, and then they have an experience, and just the awe and the shock and the veracity of their words is really compelling.
That's right. We also have equally compelling stories of people who say that I had some belief in an afterlife, but it was totally different from what I experienced in my NDE, and now I know what really happens.
Hmm. Well, this hour has flown by. I thank you so much for joining us. It's always interesting and a pleasure. And again, people can go to healthsystem.virginia.edu/DOPS. Is the Division of Perceptual Studies still looking to collect accounts? Or
Yes, we are. Yes,
okay.
We are. We're always looking for more accounts.
All right. So if people have had a near-death experience or some other experience regarding, I guess, reincarnation or one of the other areas that you study, that's the place to go.
Sure.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. Have a good evening, and hope you'll join us again.
And thank you for having me on the show tonight, Bob.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Vicki Steffi, Judith Lachman, Wendy Lippo, Kathy Ward, and again, all the people affected by the tsunami in Japan. Now let us give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico's Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, plankton, coral, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That was by Masuro Imoto back on May 9th, 2010, as the Gulf problem persists. And as we wind down our show, it's always time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.